Get ready to get your mind blown. Listen in as I interview new guests each week to share their knowledge and experiences on subjects we all wish people spoke more about. Covering all things health and wellness, you'll be sure to experience the best mindgasm you've ever had. Today, I'm joined by the wonderful Chelsea McCallum. She is an accredited practicing dietitian, nutritionist, and recipe developer. She specializes in irritable bowel syndrome and the low FODMAP diet. And today, Chelsea will be joining me to help you understand everything you need to know about IBS and how to put a stop to the embarrassing and annoying symptoms. She's also revealing the simple steps you can follow for an overall healthier gut. Hello, and welcome to Mindgasm Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks, Gemma. Thank you so much for having me.
So today we're going to be talking about IBS and FODMAPs and all of the things that go in hand with that, which includes constipation, diarrhea, all the topics which a lot of people suffer from, but nobody really speaks about. And unless you maybe have that one good friend you want to talk to about, nobody really knows what's normal, what isn't, and what sort of help they can get hold of. So we will be talking about that, but before we do, I just want to do a little rewind and understand a little bit more about yourself and how you got into being a dietitian. Because obviously you specify more in IBS dietitian now, which includes the FODMAP side, but was that always the goal, or was is that something that's come later? So tell me all.
Absolutely. So it's really interesting. I think I'm very lucky in the sense that when I finished school, I knew exactly what I wanted to study at university. And it was very clear that a degree in nutrition and dietetics was it for me. I had a lot of people say, oh, you know, there's no jobs as a dietitian. It's really tough. You should probably consider something else. But it really didn't waver my desire to be a dietitian. So I just went full steam ahead into the degree and then graduated as a dietitian, really wanted to work in private practice. So that's seeing clients in a one-to-one setting, but have dabbled in a few different areas of work. So I've done a bit of recipe development, I've done private practice, a little bit of hospital work, a little bit of aged care work as well. So there's so many different places that you can go. But I guess what got me into being more specifically just IBS was a combination of my own gut health journey and my own issues combined with seeing clients in that private practice one-to-one setting. I just saw more and more gut issues come through, and every single client that I would see, I'd ask them, oh, well, you know, how are your stools? Tell me, do you have bloating, wind, gas, all of that kind of stuff, even if they're coming in to see me for diabetes. And more often than not, people were having issues. And I thought, why are they not coming to me with the issue, but they're coming with another issue, and we're uncovering this gut health issue or these IBS-like symptoms that are really uncomfortable. And in some cases, they can be debilitating. You know, there's a lot that we can do throughout the diet. So that really triggered even more in me to niche down into that field of IBS. And I can't imagine doing anything else. I can't imagine not being a dietitian. I can't imagine not working in the IBS field now as well. So, yeah, it just seemed like the most perfect and straightforward path for me. It just makes sense and I enjoy it so much.
Do you find that people sometimes question, like, why do you enjoy talking about people's stools? Like, do you ever get people being like, what's Chelsea? Like, what's going on there?
Definitely. I think the classic, like, older gentleman that probably walks in the clinic door and is a little bit like, oh, I'm a bit uncomfortable you asking me about these issues. But for me, it's like the bread and butter. Like, I talk about it all day, every day. And, like, you're not special if I ask you about your toileting habits. Everyone gets asked these questions. And it's important because it's so indicative of what's going on, you know, potentially is there colon cancer or diverticulitis. And there's so much that we can do to help manage this kind of stuff. You really shouldn't be putting up with it. So yes, definitely some people are a little bit nervous to talk about it. Even when I get on calls with clients now as, you know, Chelsea, the IBS dietitian, people are still nervous to tell me about what goes on. And it just goes to show, you know, how much that sort of conversation is, you know, sheltered, and we're not having it often enough because we're still uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, and I wonder why we're still so uncomfortable with it, because with social media we have so much more information, which is just on the other side of our phone, and people are having these conversations, and like yourself on your Instagram, you're speaking about it all the time, yet there is still that nervousness when you do go to have that conversation.
Even if I think about scenarios for myself,
yeah,
sometimes I even get a little bit clammy and like shy talking about my toilet habits, and I'm like, well, Chelsea, how can you expect people to open up about theirs with you. So it's hard and I can't explain it. And I guess it just ties into the fact that we don't talk about it all day, every day. You know, it's not part of, like if we see our primary doctor or our general practitioner, we don't usually walk in and say, oh, by the way, I've had diarrhea for 3 days in a row, or I'm really bloated. Mm. And this stuff sometimes gets dismissed by healthcare professionals as well. You know, oh, it's normal, it will settle down, blah, blah, yeah. blah. It's probably accumulation of all of those little factors.
Yeah, that just build up over time. And then you go, the longer you go avoiding a specific topic, I feel you then get more nervous when you do go to bring it up, and then get a little bit shy. Yeah, and then it just gets avoided. But then ultimately you could be suffering with these issues, which, like you said, and obviously we'll be speaking about later, but there is ways you can help with the symptoms and help with the issues that you are suffering from.
Yeah, absolutely. You're so right.
So for anybody who is listening and they have seen this and they see the letters IBS and they're like, what is IBS?
Yeah, so IBS, it's an acronym and it stands for Irritable Bowel Syndrome. And IBS, it's very, very common in Australia. About 1 in 5 Australians have irritable bowel syndrome. 2 in 3 sufferers are women. So it's incredibly prevalent and common. And essentially, it's a functional gut disorder, which means that, you know, we could do all of the colonoscopies, endoscopies, gastroscopies, where we actually go and have a look at the bowel and the bowel looks perfect, but it's the function and the way that the bowel works, which is the issue. And potentially it's moving too quickly. It may be moving too slowly. And that really results in uncomfortable symptoms, things like being constipated or having diarrhea, and then any other associated symptoms like the bloating, the gas, the belching, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And is there a reason why some people may have one that moves slower, moves faster? Say, for example, if you have the diarrhea side versus the constipation, is there anything that contributes that, or is it just your version of IBS that you have?
There's so many different contributing factors for IBS. There's no cookie cutter way to diagnose. Yeah, exactly. So things like if you were born vaginally or if you were breastfed, that can affect your gut health and the motility of your gut. If you have followed, you know, a very low fiber diet, then you go to a vegan diet that's high fiber. Stress can impact your the motility of your gut immensely. There are so many different bits and pieces that can contribute to the development of IBS or irritable bowel syndrome.
And do you find it something that you get at a particular age, or can it be any age, young, old? You can just suddenly start with the symptoms of IBS and then you get the diagnosis?
It can affect absolutely anyone. However, we would regularly see onset before 50 years old. If we're seeing these symptoms in men and women over 50, it's a bit more of a red flag. Then we want to really be looking for things like colon cancer or polyps. But it can affect, you know, males, females. It can affect men and women, absolutely.
So it doesn't pick and choose who it's going to place its issues with. Not at all.
Yeah, exactly. You're right.
What symptoms do people usually get when they start getting IBS? Is it that, like you say, we spoke about like the constipation or the diarrhea, but is there more symptoms included in that?
And again, there's no real cookie cutter approach to this. People can come presenting with constipation only. They could have the diarrhea only. They could have a mixed type of IBS where they get constipation and diarrhea. And then they could have the whole storm, which has the constipation, diarrhea, bloating, gas. They might have heartburn and reflux. They've got all of these GI discomforts. Again, it doesn't really matter. But what we would do is get your general practitioner or your primary care doctor to diagnose with irritable bowel syndrome. And the best way to do that is to actually exclude everything else. Unfortunately, there's just no test to diagnose IBS. So they need to investigate everything else, rule that all out before we can come out with the IBS diagnosis.
It's a shame there isn't a test for IBS, isn't there? I feel like it is something that so many people suffer with. And like you say, you could be wrongly diagnosed with IBS on one side or not diagnosed with it on the other side, which is a shame that there hasn't been any further development on that.
Because, you know, it is a functional gut disorder. We can't blood test it. We can't stool sample it. Unfortunately, it does take a while to diagnose, and sometimes it's misdiagnosed because we have to do so many other investigations.
Mm-hmm. Is this might be a silly question, but is IBS different to an intolerance? You know how sometimes you can be diagnosed with it if you're an intolerance or something? Is IBS the same as that, or are they actually quite different?
Well, I guess they're very similar. So if you just come out with one intolerance, like we can test for lactose intolerance, for example, you could just have lactose intolerance and not IBS. But for someone that has IBS, they could have both. They could have the lactose intolerance and IBS. They could also just have IBS and not the lactose intolerance. So irritable bowel syndrome is linked to food intolerances, but the intolerances are so varied. There's so many different FODMAPs and groups and I guess tolerance levels to the FODMAPs that they're very similar but also slightly different.
Would it be a matter of going through the food categories to sort of work out whether you're just intolerant to one versus IBS? Like, how would you diagnose the difference of somebody being like, hey, you're intolerant to dairy?
So I guess we can, backtrack slightly. So IBS, one of the most common treatment and management strategies for IBS is the low FODMAP diet. And we use that low FODMAP diet to diagnose intolerances. So we would do, and we can talk through exactly what FODMAP stands for. We will do an elimination phase where we eliminate as many FODMAPs as possible. We do a reintroduction phase, and that is the only way to diagnose the intolerance. You know, there's no test that we can do for testing your intolerance to galacto-oligosaccharides or our GOS-containing foods. You must do a structured elimination and reintroduction. So although, you know, IBS is not a food intolerance, we use the low FODMAP diet to diagnose intolerance related to IBS. It's a little bit complicated, really.
using the FODMAP diet process that we will be speaking about, so don't worry, anybody, don't panic. You don't need to know what that means just yet. But the process you use for that will also help to diagnose whether you have IBS or an intolerance.
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay, that makes sense. Is IBS curable? Or is it something?
Unfortunately, no. It's something that you do live with long term. However, it can go through phases of remission, but also it can be so easily managed that you can get it to a point that you wouldn't know that you have IBS. You know, maybe you've just got a bit of a sensitive tummy, but certainly not something that we can cure yet. Again, it's something the research is out on, and we are keeping our ears to the ground and waiting to hear if there's anything new.
Yeah, because you see a lot of, I know there's lots of like tablets and stuff which you can take to help with the impact of IBS, but I guess they're putting a bit of a plaster on it or just relieving the symptoms of it, as opposed to actually curing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of the over-the-counter stuff or that you could buy from a pharmacy or chemist, it is a little bit like putting a Band-Aid or plaster on it. What we want to do as a dietitian is come in from the root cause, you know, what is triggering these symptoms, and that's where we would implement something like the low FODMAP diet.
What would you say are like your top tips for trying to help with symptoms of IBS? Because obviously we've got the FODMAP diet, which goes to the root cause, but say you're still during that process and you are suffering with issues, have you got any top tips that you would recommend?
I hate to say it, but my top tip is like literally always see a dietitian or ask your doctor if you can see a dietitian. I know it's like not the easiest thing, but it just allows, you know, a skilled professional to go through your diet with a fine tooth comb, look at your lifestyle factors as well so that they can understand it all, because there's so much information on the internet and it's so confusing and conflicting that people often go around in a circle looking for something to do. But if they had just gone to a dietitian that's trained in the low FODMAP diet, specializes in IBS, like they could be feeling better within 2 weeks' time, you know, and that's pretty dramatic
for people that have.
Exactly. Like people put up with IBS for 30 years, they can come and see a dietitian and feel better in 2 weeks. So it can be transformative, right? So that's why it's my top tip. But then my second top tip would be try not to Google. You know, if you're going to get information, go to, you know, some of our best sites. So maybe Monash University. In Australia, I always recommend GESA, which is the Gastroenterology Society of Australia. You want to go to these leading bodies that provide us with really great solid research and really good information as well. Mm-hmm. And then my third piece of advice is keep a food diary and try and track what you're eating, drinking, how much sleep you're getting, your exercise, and see if you can link your symptoms to things that are happening throughout your day.
Mm-hmm. Is exercise something you find that can actually help relieve symptoms? Is there much link to IBS and exercise?
I think exercise can be a bit of a double-edged sword because it can help IBS, but it also can trigger IBS. So specifically, okay. if I have someone with IBSD or diarrhea predominant IBS and they're doing a lot of HIIT training or a lot of sprints, I would probably say let's tone that back a little bit because it can trigger more intense symptoms. And then on the flip side, if I've got someone with constipation predominant IBS, exercise is really helpful because one of the leading causes of constipation is physical inactivity, so no movement. Mm-hmm. Movement can help to relieve stress as well. So if stress is one of their big triggers of IBS, it can be really helpful. So I guess putting in movement that works for the individual is really important.
It's interesting how the exercise can be good or bad. So you really do kind of need to understand what type of IBS you have before you go running off and be just reading one thing online and saying, okay, yeah, this is right for me. And actually it could have the adverse effect.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of people I know suffer with bloating with IBS. I personally do have IBS and I find that peppermint tea really helps. Mm. Is that a myth or is there some sort of health and science behind that?
Yep, there absolutely is. So peppermint and peppermint oil capsules can be really beneficial for helping relieve bloating. And that's because the peppermint actually helps to soothe the muscles in the intestine, which helps to relax any muscle spasm and then pass any trapped gas. So peppermint tea is certainly effective, but if people are looking for something more, they can get... I know in the UK they have Colpamin, in Australia we use Mintec, and then in the US there's IB Guard, and they're just enterically coated peppermint oil capsules, which means they pop when they get to your large intestine and they actually help to relieve that muscle spasm. So really effective for bloating.
And is it very much just either the peppermint tea, the capsules, the oils, as opposed to anything peppermint? So sometimes you can have, say, mints are seen as helping with sickness and uncomfortable bellies, but is there much support, would you say, from IBS with just taking a spearmint or peppermint?
With the spearmints and peppermints, a lot of them have artificial sweeteners in them, right, which can trigger more uncomfortable gut symptoms. So they're not something that I'd recommend. Plus, we really need them to go to the large bowel, the small intestine at least, to have effect. So if the spearmint is totally absorbed in the stomach or broken down by enzymes, it's not going to do anything, unfortunately. So really taking those enterically coated peppermint oil capsules are going to give you the best chance. Peppermint tea as well could help.
So a lot of people are going to be making notes, running to the supermarket to buy all their peppermint capsules and tea.
Out of stock.
Absolutely. Let's talk about FODMAP. So we touched on it briefly, but what does FODMAP stand for? What do you mean?
Yeah, it's a bit of a funny word. FODMAP is an acronym as well, and it stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. And now you understand why it's an acronym, because it's a massive mouthful. All of those funny words that end in saccharide are carbohydrates, and then polyols are sugar alcohols. And we find these small components in really healthy foods and fruits, like fruits and vegetables, like apples, peaches, stone fruit. We can find them in vegetables like asparagus and broccolini, cauliflower, mushrooms. Nuts and seeds are high FODMAPs as well, and then some legumes as well. These unfortunately are poorly digested and malabsorbed in the stomach, which means they move through the small intestine and then onto the large intestine, where they can cause a lot of discomfort because these small compounds, the FODMAPs, are often fermented and malabsorbed by the bacteria that live in our bowel, which can draw fluid into the bowel, which can cause diarrhea, or they're rapidly fermented, which causes a lot of bloating gas and in some people constipation as well. Mm-hmm. So in a nutshell, that's FODMAPs.
Well, I just feel like I've had an hour science lesson in 2 minutes.
So it is a little bit complicated.
Yeah, let's break that down a little bit. So if somebody was, okay, coming in and they were listening to this and they have potentially have IBS and they were at home and wanting to do a bit of a food diary themselves using the FODMAP method, how would they even begin with that?
Start writing everything down and then really using something like the Monash University FODMAP app to go through and have a look at which foods, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, breads, all that kind of stuff, which ones are high FODMAP. It's a really helpful tool. And there's a lot of lists online that say these are all the high FODMAP foods that you need to avoid. But, you know, we're retesting and testing new foods all the time. So we really need to be using something up to date like the Monash University app. Mm-hmm. So that would be my recommendation if they're wanting to do it on their own.
So it basically, in like a layman terms, the FODMAP meaning is foods that are going to cause you irritation, and the diet that you would recommend is one that avoids the foods that are in the FODMAP group.
Exactly. And I guess what I should clarify is that it's not a diet. We don't do the low FODMAP diet long term. It's a process. And we really should rename it the low FODMAP process, because you need to eliminate for 2 to 6 weeks, no more. If you've eliminated FODMAPs for longer than 6 weeks and you haven't had symptom relief, we need to do something else. And then vice versa, even if you have had symptom relief, you actually need to reintroduce those FODMAPs to diagnose the particular intolerances, so that you don't have to follow that elimination restriction long term, because it's not good for your gut health. It's not good socially, because you've got to cut out lots of beautiful things like onions and garlics and all sorts of goodies.
So it'd be a matter of remove them all for 2 to 6 weeks until you start to see a difference. Then do you introduce by food group, or do you just gradually introduce by what you desire?
We definitely need to do a really structured reintroduction. You can't go willy-nilly and say introduce apples one day and maybe peaches the next. Unfortunately, you need to do specific foods that contain only one type of FODMAP. So an apple's not a good example, because I know that it has sorbitol as well as fructose in it. So how do we know if you're reacting to the fructose or the sorbitol? Mm-hmm. So for your fructose challenge, for example, you might use honey because it's only got fructose in it. And then you would do some very specific challenge doses over a 3-day challenge period, and then do a washout period before you move on to another challenge. You document your progress, and then you can extrapolate that data from the honey to sort of suggest how you would be with other high fructose foods like honey, or what else is high fructose? Orange juice, broccolini, these kind of foods.
Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure you're not crossing your wires with any other sort of thing that could cause irritation, because it would make it harder to recognize.
Exactly. We want to make sure that when you do that reintroduction period, you get really clear results. Mm-hmm. So then you actually never have to do it again. And you've got that really succinct list of foods that you know you tolerate and the foods that you know you don't tolerate. And maybe you've got some in the middle, which are like your orange or yellow foods that you can tolerate in small amounts, but you're going to go a bit slow with them.
And if you reintroduce a food that you don't tolerate, would you recommend cutting it out completely, and you sort of see it as, okay, your body doesn't digest that well, so let's avoid that for the foreseeable? Or is it a matter of resetting your body and leaving it for, say, a year and then retrying to introduce it again? Like, can you get over these, the way that your body reacts? Yeah.
It really depends which one it is. You know, for things like fructose and lactose, they're linked to an enzyme deficiency. So things like fructose, you can't build a tolerance to it. For lactose, you can take a digestive enzyme, which helps you break it down. And then other FODMAP groups like our fructans and our galacto-oligosaccharides, we can build your tolerance to these. So it really does depend which ones you come out with being intolerant to.
Okay. And sometimes people can have, particularly, I'm not going back to lactose intolerances, but if you have, say, a dairy intolerance, but you're only intolerant to specific foods of dairy rather than the full category, is that a common thing?
Well, I guess it comes down to the lactose content of the food usually. So most of the time people can tolerate things like butter or ghee or cheeses like feta cheese, cheddar cheese, Swiss cheese, low lactose products. When it comes to things like milk, ice cream, yogurt, or custard, because they're much higher lactose, they cause a more severe reaction. So that's one scenario where people could get away with it. Usually, if they can't tolerate any dairy whatsoever, even, you know, the smallest amount of milk powder in, you know, a shelf stable product, that potentially is linked to a cow's milk protein allergy. So then it's another kettle of fish, and that's a whole other conversation.
I did a food tolerance test in myself a little while ago, and it did break down the different proteins, and I found it really interesting how you could have I personally had an issue with cow's milk but not an issue with goat's milk. And so would that come to the protein side, which you just touched on there, because the protein's different?
Yeah, exactly. It's like an immune response, essentially. So you are tolerating the proteins differently. And, you know, some people can't tolerate collagen or protein isolate. It just, it's, I guess, yeah, like I said, it's a different conversation, a whole nother kettle of fish. Most of the time, it's more common to just be intolerant to the FODMAPs. But if you needed to go down that food chemical or protein testing, that would be something that you could do as well.
And what would you say is there a regular amount of bowel movement that we should all be having? Like, does it vary per gender, or is it kind of like, okay, depends on like your normal cycle? Like, what would you recommend? Because sometimes you can have it every day, 2-3 times totally. A day, or not for weeks. Like, what is a normal? I put bunny ears, normal, like normal. Yeah.
I know, normal with bunny ears. Yeah. look, we say anywhere from 3 times a day to 3 times a week, which is a huge variation.
That's
right?
Very varied.
Which is super varied. And I don't love it. I would prefer that someone is going every day or at least every other day. But it comes down to the individual and what they're satisfied with. Because if someone is satisfied with going twice a day and it actually being well formed and that there being no, loose texture to it, they're really happy with that. I'm happy with that. Mm-hmm. It really comes back to the individual. And especially if they've come from having loose bowel motions 3 or 4 times a day to having bowel motions twice a day and it being quite well formed, that's a massive win. And vice versa with constipation. If I've got someone that's only going to the restroom once a week, if they start going 3 times a week, but they're very satisfied with it, I'm satisfied with it as well.
Mm-hmm. So it isn't necessarily what your body needs. Obviously there's a range, but within what you just said, that would kind of yes. be okay. It doesn't matter too much yeah. that it's not every day. Because I feel like the media can often put forward that you should be going every day. And if you're not going every day, then you're not eating healthily, but that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. I mean, it comes back to the individual. I would love everyone to go every single day and happily, but like, you know, full evacuation or et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I understand it's also, I'm a realist. It might not be achievable for everyone.
Yeah. And if you are somebody who suffers from bloating, potentially it's because you're not going every day, what can you do to help with that bloating in the immediate, especially that if it's linked with passing wind? Is the passing wind normal, or is that linked to IBS, or is that something
passing
separate?
Wind is normal. Yeah. So everyone should have a little bit of wind. I want to put it out there that if you are not farting and you're not passing wind,
yeah,
I'm actually a little bit concerned for you. You need to have a little bit of gas, and it means that your microbes are doing something. So a little bit of gas is normal, but when it's uncomfortable, or when you feel like you need to hold it in and you feel bloated and you don't feel comfortable in your body, if you are in bed with your partner, etc., that's when we want to address the issue. And look, you know, band-aid fixing is okay short term, but you want to get to the root cause. You want to know why you're getting the bloating. Is it because you're having high FODMAP foods? Is it because you're constipated? Is it because you're not drinking enough fluid, not moving your body enough? We want to find out why, so that you don't keep coming back to this really uncomfortable feeling, because dating someone new with IBS is not fun. You know, ideally you'd be able to get to the bottom of it before, you know, you open yourself up like that to someone.
But we are saying that let's normalize farting. Like, farting's okay.
Yes.
Like, it's good.
Farting
as long as you're
okay.
not uncomfortable, like, please
yes,
do as
exactly.
much farting as you want.
Let it out. Yeah, exactly. Like,
yeah.
everyone does it. It's like everyone poops. It's funny, isn't it?
It's one of those taboo things where you're just like, okay, yeah, I poop, but do you fart? It's like, yes.
Yes.
we all do, but nobody admits it. What
yeah,
about...
Totally.
Obviously, in the line with the farting, we've got burping. And is there a difference as to why some people would fart and some people burp? Like, what's the deal with that?
Well, I guess it's depending on where the gas is forming in your GI system, because if it forms in the upper small intestine or your stomach, of course, it's more likely to come up as a belch or a burp. Mm-hmm. If it's forming in your lower small intestine or your colon, it's more likely to come out as a fart, right? It just makes anatomical sense. Usually if someone's a bit more burpy, it's probably carbonated beverages or some of our other reflux triggers. So like citrus foods, a lot of alcohol, coffee or smoking can trigger belching and heartburn. But then in the lower GI system, it's more likely to be FODMAPs or constipation or lack of fluid and movement that's causing that.
What would you say your thoughts are on colon cleanses and I'm going to probably ruin the name of this, but colonic? Yeah, colonic.
Yeah. I'm not a fan. I'm really not a fan because the risk is that we wash out bad bacteria, but we're also washing out good bacteria. Yeah, I would strongly suggest against anyone getting them done. And usually it's not under the guidance of a medical professional either. You know, there's small clinics dotted around the place which claim to have nurse practitioners or, you know, whatever they might have on the team. But I'm not a fan of them.
For anybody listening who's not sure what a colon cleanse is, just for reference, this is when you flush out a large portion of your bowel system using a tube, which they, I guess, insert into your rectum, and then water is pushed through with force. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if it's done with, I've never had one. I don't 100% know. I don't know if it's done with force or not, but certainly fluid is pushed up into, your colon to help flush things out, which seems like the most uncomfortable and unsafe thing in my head. A big no-no.
I suppose you mentioned about the, you can't obviously decide whether good bacteria is flushed out or bad bacteria. So the impact of that down the line isn't potentially worth it.
Yeah, exactly. Because that gut microbiome that you've got is so valuable because it can contribute to so many other things beyond gut health. We know that a healthy and diverse gut microbiome is linked with reduced risk of obesity and some cancers and reduced inflammation. So you want to nurture that. You don't want to flush it out and then have to start from scratch. You know, potentially you can't start from scratch either.
Yeah, especially if it's taking you however long to get there. You know, that's going to be a long journey.
From birth. from birth. The second you're born. Yes.
You're going to be flushing away so many years of hard work.
So many goodies, yeah.
I'm assuming then your thoughts on the detox teas would be a similar standpoint, or is that a little bit different?
Same sort of a thing. Yeah, I guess a lot of the detox teas, they work by using laxatives, which help you go to the restroom, which make you feel really relieved and like you've got no bloating because there's no stool sitting in your colon. But your body can become reliant on these laxatives, right? Because they're directly affecting the muscle and how the muscle functions. If you're using them for a prolonged period of time, your body becomes reliant on them, and then your bowel will become lazy, contributing to more constipation and more issues. So absolutely, detox teas, colonics, Big red no. Please listen.
I suppose sometimes what leads people to doing the detox teas is if they have had a heavy 2-3 weeks, maybe longer, a few months, and have been eating really unhealthy and they want to have that reset. And if that reset isn't through detox teas because of the issues that you've just mentioned, how do you give your body that reset in a healthy way?
Keep it simple. Like, honestly, drink enough fluids for your body weight. You want to aim for 30 mils per kilogram of body weight, or you want to be having half a fluid ounce per pound of body weight. You want to be eating a diverse range of fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds. We have this magic number of 30 different plant foods per week. And that sounds like a lot, but if you have a handful of mixed nuts, you have two different types of fruit a day, you have three different types of vegetables a day, really, really easy to get there because it includes things like your herbs, your spices, your grains. Stick with that, you know, go for walks in nature, expose yourself to outdoor microbes, you know, cuddle your pets, for example. We know people that cuddle their animals have more diverse gut microbiomes because of the animal's gut microbiome. Simple stuff, right? And it sounds really funny and it's not sexy and it's not appealing. And unfortunately, that's why a lot of people go for these detox teas, because they have really big, bold promises. That just draw people in. And I don't blame anyone for it, because like, it sounds attractive, right? To beat the bloat or blah, blah, blah. And no one wants to hear you just need to eat more fruits and vegetables. Like, that's old news.
Yeah, it's like, really, Gemma Chelsea, this is the best you've got. It's 2021 and you're telling me to have more vegetables. Totally. Like, what is going on?
Fake news, old news. Yeah, I know. But that's my best advice. And it's always going to come back to that, right? It's always going to be super simple stuff. Anything that's like shockingly too good to be true, looks sexy, is appealing, usually it's all smoke and mirrors.
And it's a quick fix, which I guess your body can bounce back the opposite direction as soon as you stop doing it, which with a detox tea, you're not going to do for a prolonged period of time anyway. No. So it just kind of counteracts itself a little bit.
Exactly. Keep it sustainable. Do something that you could do for the rest of your life. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the 30 is the magic number. So 30 different like fruits, vegetables, grains throughout the week. Is this the new 5 a day or 7 a day, whatever it is now? Is this the same version?
I suppose so. It's research that's come out of the UK and is really looking at gut microbiome diversity and healthy gut microbiomes and all of the benefits that can come out of that. So like I said, 30 different plant foods per week. It can be fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, grains, herbs, spices. It doesn't, not necessarily do we want you to have you know, crazy amounts of plant fibers, because that can upset your stomach as well. We just want you to have diverse plant fibers, because we know that the fiber in a carrot is going to feed different microbes to the fiber in an apple. So we want to give your microbiome different types of foods so they can ferment on those, produce some short chain fatty acids, which are the beneficial factors coming from that fermentation.
Interesting. So it's the key point, I suppose, would be 30 different types of fruit and veg, different. As opposed to just having 30. Yeah. Same. So you, instead of having 30 apples. Carrots or apples, yeah, then you're not going to get that same effect to what the different variations would be able to offer you.
Yes, exactly. So 30 different plant foods is the key.
Different. Interesting. And then I guess when you introduce that, you'll be able to see how your body reacts. But you could also be introducing food you're maybe not as familiar with, which could also cause issues.
Yes, exactly. So I guess this, if you've got IBS and you're wanting to diversify your diet, that's where working with a dietitian can be handy. Putting in, you know, FODMAP-free fruits and vegetables, whole grains, nuts and seeds. There's so many different things that we can do.
Yeah, you didn't mention anything about meat, and that is that because you are more encouraging of vegan diets and vegetarian diets, or do you see any like bad sides to having meat included in your diet? What are your thoughts?
Not necessarily. You know, I eat all types of meat and I enjoy meat and fish and chicken, all of that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah.
I do strongly believe that you know, we all should have a more plant-based diet. We should be focusing on those 30 and then putting a little bit of protein in to help with things like iron and zinc, but also to help with satiation. So making sure that we feel really full. But the key player or the main component of our meals, it probably should be our fruits, our vegetables, our whole grains, nuts and seeds, right? Mm-hmm. We should have that small amount of protein. But again, we could be using plant-based protein. So it could be tofu, tempeh, or textured vegetable protein, whatever someone prefers. Absolutely, I'm not against meat, chicken, fish, seafood, all of that kind of stuff.
So this kind of is not, one isn't wrong or right. It's very much include both, but primarily your focus of your plate should be the fruits, the vegetables, the herbs, the seeds. Foods. Yeah, the plant-based foods.
Yeah, which exactly.
Makes it a little bit easier for people to follow. I feel that a lot of, over the last year or two, there's a lot more food trends that have come around and do's and don'ts of what you should or shouldn't be doing. But ultimately, I guess your standpoint would be that as long as you're balanced and you're focusing on the main bits, then adding in a bit of everything else is okay.
Yep, absolutely it is. Yeah, definitely. I guess from a gut health perspective, you know, a diet too rich in protein is not good. You know, you having some chicken or steak with dinner doesn't do much for your gut health, but the diversity of plant foods does. So that's why I push it so much.
It definitely, I think, keeps it simple. As we were saying before, if you don't need to overcomplicate things, if you have a simple way of looking at it, it also makes it sustainable for you to be able to carry on for the rest of your life, which ultimately is the goal that you want to be able to do.
The goal. Yeah,
exactly. Absolutely.
If you can't do something for the rest of your life, why would you start it?
Yeah, it is very true. If you are somebody who is just starting out and you are wanting to look at your gut health and just work on basically improving it in general, where would you say to begin with? Like maybe you haven't got IBS and you are just wanting an overall healthier gut. What would you say is the best thing you could do there?
We're going to circle back to 30 different plant foods. I'll give you a few different tips then. We'll go back to 30 different plant foods. That's number one, absolutely. Number two is looking after your mental health as well. So going for walks, getting some vitamin D, you know, improving gut health. That's fantastic because we know there's such a big, strong link between our mental health, our gut health, and vice versa. And then the third thing that I would say is, you know, include some fermented or probiotic rich foods as well. If it's going to be things that kefir or miso or tempeh, these fermented products can help deliver diversity, you know, in plant-based foods, but also some beneficial bacteria as well.
With the probiotics, because there's a lot of push around the probiotic yogurts, because it's a great way to be able to get that into your system. Do you agree with that, or do you feel there's a little bit more of an advertising marketing approach?
It really depends on the specific brand that you're talking about, but protein-based probiotics like kefir or yogurt, they're more likely to survive stomach acid. So they're really what I would push as well above things like sauerkraut and kombucha. You know, they do have the live bacteria. If they survive stomach acid, we don't really know, but we certainly know that protein-bound probiotics are more likely to do so. So yeah, I would definitely be pushing more yogurt or kefir-based products.
And then you just mentioned kombucha, which a lot of people have been speaking about the health benefits around kombucha, because there's the drink that you could have it, which I have tried and I wasn't a huge fan of the taste, but each to their own. Do you agree with the science behind that and the push that people are having with helping your gut?
It's very trendy, and who knows what's just around the corner, because kombucha's probably had its time, but you know, it's essentially a fermented tea. It has live bacteria in it, but like I said, we don't know if it survives your stomach acid. Therefore, we don't know if it gives you the benefit of the live bacteria, because they need to make their way to the large bowel, which is pretty far from the stomach if you think about, you know, the 7 meter small intestine that it's got to go through as well. So we can't call something like kombucha a probiotic. We can say that the kombucha has live bacteria, but because we haven't been able to prove that it has a benefit for human consumption, it's just a fermented drink and that's all it is, but it's trendy and people go for it. And look, it's delicious. I like it.
You like it.
If people prefer to drink kombucha over beer, or if they prefer to drink it over soft drink or soda, I'm happy for them to do that.
Yeah. If there's a, I guess if there's the potential that it could be doing some good, then why not? Because having a soft drink, you know, it's not going to be doing anything. So let's hold on to that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, exactly. So I think it's a wonderful alternative, and why not? If people enjoy it and they like it, go for it.
Many people suffer with having a very flat belly on the morning when they wake up, and then by evening it gets to PM and they are super bloated, and they get like the bloat that you get at the end of the meal, but they don't have IBS. Now, is that just because our body is processing the foods, or is that potentially just because it doesn't like something we've had? Is there like an issue there, or is that quite normal?
It could be a mix of things, and I guess it comes back to how bad is the bloat. If you feel like you're looking 9 months pregnant and you can't hold it in, you're uncomfortable, definitely we need to have a look and see what's going on there. But it's not normal to have a completely flat stomach all day, because you're eating, you're drinking, you're standing up straight, you're slouching, you know, your clothes could be uncomfortable. There's all of these things that can contribute to it.
Yep.
So I guess the individual's got to determine how bad it is, and if it's if it's comfortable or not, or if they can attribute it to a big meal, or if they can attribute it to poor posture, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And so it's more if it's causing you pain, I suppose. If it's causing you any discomfort, then that's when it's a concern. But if you have a bit of bloat throughout the day, that is completely normal.
Totally normal. Yeah. It's like passing gas. Totally normal.
Back to the passing gas. We're passing gas. We're doing pooping. It all. We're pooping. We're pooping. Everything's normal. Where do you see the IBS world going, like, over the next couple of years? Do you feel like people are going to get more educated and more help is going to come? Or is it a matter of us educating ourselves and doing what we can at home?
I think it's great now that we have this sort of section of social media, whether it be Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, where we've got health professionals on there as well, which is fabulous and fascinating to help sort of guide people that, you know, potentially don't know any better and wouldn't necessarily be looking for this information. So I do see that the conversation is opening up, the education is growing. So I'm excited to see where the space goes and if we continue to move in this path.
But how do you know who to listen to for advice? Because as you say, loads of people are giving their advice at the moment, which is amazing, but there can be people maybe giving it and they don't really know.
Yeah, I totally agree. With whatever it is, if it's IBS or if it's PCOS or if it's endometriosis, whatever health concern, look for someone that is trained and credible and, you know, genuinely knows what they're talking about, has a degree, has done the evidence or the research, so that you can trust them. Because everyone has to eat, everyone has an opinion on food, whether it comes down to IBS or PCOS, like I said. Look for someone that's been to university, potentially has their lived experience as well, has done extra training and is continuing to do extra training as well so that they're up to date with what's going on. That's my best advice, is try and listen to a professional. And if you're Googling, go to those well-established research institutes for that information.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that different dietitians will suggest different pieces of advice? Like, you maybe have a client who comes to you who's been to somebody else, and then it can vary? Mm-hmm. Or is generally what you hear, as long as it's coming from someone who's accredited, is the right sort of approach?
It's tough. It's really tough. And I think because I'm a dietitian and I've been in this situation, I can say this. I have been a dietitian that sees clients in a face-to-face private practice where weight loss will walk in, heart disease walks in, IBS walks in, fertility nutrition walks in, and you have to know a little bit about everything. And you can never really niche down, and you can never be an expert in the field. When I started to go into IBS, you start seeing only IBS patients, and then that becomes your bread and butter, I don't know if I would ever know everything about it, but you know so much more about the topic because that's all that you're reading about, that's all that you're talking about. So you become, you know, an expert within that field. Mm-hmm. So I do have a handful of clients that come to me and say, oh, I've seen a dietitian before, how is this going to be different? And the difference is, well, this is my niche, this is my bread and butter, I've gone through what you've gone through. And I can only say this because I've been that dietitian before that had to see everyone, which couldn't specialize in IBS or couldn't specialize in PCOS. So mm-hmm. I know that if you're going to see someone for whatever health concern it is, you know, do your best to, you know, the best of your ability to see someone that is specialized in that field so that you get the best level of care and you don't, you know, dabble here with a dietitian and dabble there with another dietitian and then feel unsatisfied with your results or the information provided and the support that you get as well.
That is a really good point to make, because I guess there's a lot of dietitians who are able to help with your issues, but if you have a specific issue such as IBS, then you want somebody who's very familiar with that topic and has seen every man and his dog and knows exactly what you're talking about when you walk into the room, because it can be, as we've said at the start, it can be a bit of an uncomfortable topic to talk about when you're talking about your poo or you're talking about your farts. It's like you want someone who's very familiar with that, which ultimately you get if you're a specialist in it.
If you're listening and you want to see an IBS dietitian, if it's not me, it should be someone else that's qualified, that's local to you or online. It doesn't matter. But that's always my best piece of advice, is get someone that you know is confident in that field.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time and joining me today. I'm definitely taking notes myself, and I'm sure many of us are, but it's been really helpful. So thank you.
It's been such a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Gemma.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed your Mindgasm. Remember, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And make sure to follow me on Instagram at Jen Bezza to send in any questions and be the first to find out who we have coming up next. Have a great day. Hey.